If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Tuesday, October the 8th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Research Fellow. My guest today here in Hoover's recording studio here on the campus of Stanford University is David Leal. David Leal is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and a professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin, hokum horns. His primary academic interest is Latino politics, and his work explores the political and policy implications of demographic change in the United States. He's been here at Hoover the past couple of weeks and is soon headed back to Austin, so I thought it was a good time for us to catch up on what is going on in the great state of Texas, talk about what is going on back there, and also talk about his forte to Latino voters. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, and hokum horns.
Yes, so I did a little sleuthing before this because I know you take your business seriously, so I wanted to show you I take this business seriously as well. So the last time Texas went Democratic in a presidential election was?
Jimmy Carter.
Very good. What was his margin of victory?
I probably have it here somewhere. I think it was about 3%.
3.2. Very good.
Right. But Clinton almost won, too.
Clinton did. So it's interesting. So Clinton came very close in 1992. I think it was also in the threes, but that's with Perot siphoning off 22% of the vote, I believe,
that's
in
right.
Texas. But then as we move forward, David, in 1996, Bob Dole wins by 4.9%. 2000, 2004, well, that's a native son, and he wins by over 20%, I believe, each time. 2008, John McCain wins by 12%. 2012, Mitt Romney wins by a hair under 16%. But then 2016, Donald Trump wins by less than 10%, 9%. He got 52% of the statewide vote. If you look at those votes specifically, David, Trump got 4.685 million votes. That's 120,000 more than Mitt Romney. But Hillary Clinton received 3.877 million votes, 570,000 more than Barack Obama. So he went up a little bit. She went up a lot. What do we read from those numbers?
Well, I think a lot of people assume that Texas politics is moving in a single direction, that if you look at the data that you'll see Democrats just doing steadily better over the years and Republicans maybe having peaked in the 90s or early 2000s are now in a kind of decline. But I think these data point out that election context matters, the candidates matter, that Texas isn't immune from national trends and the nationalization of elections. And so I don't think that we can really say that the Texas Democratic Party is sort of, you know, just poised to victory because there's been this steady march over the years and they're just within just a few points of it, like the Beto-Cruz election might suggest. I think there's, if you look at these data, you'll see that it goes up and down a little bit. So I think that the Texas story is a more complicated story than a lot of the simple turn Texas blue kind of, you know, punditry might suggest.
Right. So let's try to uncomplicate it a little bit, starting with Donald Trump himself. Why did he not crack 10% as a margin of victory in 2016? What held him back?
Well, I think part of the issue is that the base of the Republican Party is changing a little bit. So there's been a lot of talk about how the Republicans are doing better among a working class voter and about how the Democrats are now doing better in the suburbs. And so to the degree that Texas politics has been, as Ted Cruz said not too long ago, characterized by blue dots surrounded by red donuts, but now he says it's characterized by blue dots surrounded by purple donuts. As the suburban heart of the GOP starts to become a little bit more Democratic, maybe not turning blue, but getting certainly a little more purple, that's sort of undercutting some of the base. And there's also been claims, and there's been some contestation about this recently, about whether newcomers to Texas, whether they're internal U.S. migrants or coming from another country, are changing the basis of the vote in Texas. So I think there's probably all of these things that are going on right now.
Can you explain a little bit of the difference between the Trump vote in 2016 and the Cruz vote in 2018? What was Cruz's margin of victory in 2018?
Cruz won by about 2.6. It was something along those lines.
So much closer than Trump. Right. But he had to struggle for that victory. He had to work for it.
He certainly did, right. Yeah. I mean, I think there are a lot of factors going on. I think part of it is, you know, Cruz lost a presidential campaign against Trump. I'm not sure if that sort of helped him in running as his own person just 2 years later. I also think that, you know, Cruz had gotten a lot of publicity, not all of it positive, and I think that probably had something to do with it also. But the Democrats also kind of got lucky. Beto O'Rourke just kind of caught lightning in a bottle, and sometimes candidates can come around and do that, and sometimes other candidates who might Might not be bad candidates, or they might be similar in some kind of ways. They might not catch on. After all, Rourke was, he was a member of Congress from El Paso, and there hasn't never been, I think, somebody I read online, a native El Pasoan who has become, won a statewide election or become governor at least. And so I think that there's, you know, why him and why not somebody else? Sometimes candidates just do really well. And so I think there was a confluence of circumstances, Cruz, Trump, and O'Rourke, that all led to this. But I don't think that we should necessarily extrapolate from this and say, all right, 3% is now the margin going forward, because at the very same time, Governor Abbott, who's fairly popular, won by about 13 percentage points. So clearly the voters, including Latino voters, are differentiating between these candidates.
Right. So, David, I ascribe to the Charlie Brown School of Presidential Politics that both parties each election are guilty of the Charlie Brown crime of trying to kick the football and having the football yanked away. And what I mean by this is every 4 years, Democrats become convinced they can carry Georgia. And every 4 years, they become convinced they can carry Arizona. Republicans think they can carry Minnesota, New Mexico, and surprise, the football gets yanked away and they end up rather predictable. But you're hearing the early buzz now about Texas being in play for Democrats in 2020.
That's right. And I think some of that's premature. I think that some of the other states you mentioned, the Democrats have come close in Georgia. And I think there are sort of population change reasons for that. The Democrats did win in Arizona. They may win again in the next Senate race. And who knows what will happen in the presidential campaign. At the same time, the Arizona Democratic gubernatorial candidate lost.
But Texas, because if Democrats win Texas, that's 38 electoral votes. The game is over for Republicans. You take away 38 from Trump's total in 2016. He's not in the White House right now.
Oh, sure. No Republican becomes president, really, without winning Texas.
Right.
So if the Democrats win Texas, which I don't think will happen, but if they do, then it's sort of game over. And who cares what happens in Ohio and all these other battleground states? You know, it's kind of done.
Right. So John Kennedy in 1963 goes to Texas. He goes to Houston. He goes to Fort Worth. He goes to Dallas. And he is mending fences on that trip. He's trying to end a rift within the Democratic Party. And he's also getting in some groundwork for the 1964 campaign, which he recognizes is going to go through Texas in part. How much work does Donald Trump have to do in Texas?
It's hard to say whether or not sort of work will make a difference, because I think that Trump's approval ratings have been fairly stuck, and they've been in that low 40% range. And I've seen some data showing that Trump's opinion polls have shown a lot less movement, as I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with, than a lot of other presidents in recent history, recent decades. So, so I don't know if it's really a matter of Trump. I feel like a lot of Trump's support and opposition is already baked in many ways. And so I don't know if sort of like if work, if coming to Texas, if having a rally, if that sort of thing is really going to make much of a difference. Voters have in many ways made up a lot of their minds, and it'll be interesting to start looking at data from here on out about how many people are actually undecided and who they are in the presidential campaign. Certainly some of the surveys have been giving hope to Democrats. So in some of these election matchups of Biden versus Trump or Harris versus Trump, Biden pretty consistently has been doing well in those matchups, winning by you know, several percentage points, sometimes even more. Some surveys show other Democrats winning, but I think a lot of them also show them not winning.
Right.
More of them show that it's really just Biden that's popular.
It seems like when Trump does go to Texas, he tends to go to the border to do wall events, to talk immigration. If he wanted to go the JFK route, though, and mend fences, where would you send him? Would you send him to suburban Dallas, suburban Houston? Where would you send him to try to pick up the vote?
Well, maybe it depends on what he wants to say. So he went to El Paso not too long ago, where he said lots of nice things about Latinos.
Yes.
But is that going to be a kind of a consistent message?
Right.
So I don't really know whether or not I would sort of recommend that he go to any one particular place. I think it depends on whether or not he and his consultants have a campaign strategy for trying to minimize what must be worrying them a little bit, these polls showing that, you know, his popularity in Texas is really in many ways split, and that could very well lead to, of all things, a Democrat potentially winning the statewide vote.
Right. You mentioned Greg Abbott, the incumbent governor of Texas right now. He is now in his second term. He's up for a third term in 2022, right? He will be 67 years old in 2024. Is he somebody who should be whispered about in presidential circles?
I don't see why any politician who does well in Texas shouldn't be whispered about in national political circles. I think it depends a little bit on maybe how they govern. And I think a lot of Texas politicians, and I know that many of your listeners may be in California, and so they may have stereotypes of Texas, but Let me say that my view of Texas is that it is in many ways a kind of, you know, business-oriented, kind of center-right, kind of practical place. I think Texas is a kind of state that's focused on opportunity, on people doing well. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of the successful Texas politicians have learned to be in that kind of middle space. It doesn't mean that they're in the ideological middle, but they're in the middle for the state of Texas, which I think is a place that has a lot of lessons for the country. And so I think that to the degree that somebody like Rick Perry or somebody like Abbott have been able to sort of navigate that and be successful and win re-elections, it shows that, you know, they have something to say to the rest of the country.
So not too long ago, David, I saw a really funny picture. It was taken in Dallas, and it was a store. It was a Goop store being opened in Dallas. Goop is the franchise that Gwyneth Paltrow came out, which sells all kinds of incredibly high-end priced products to women.
I learn something every day.
Exactly. And there was a very funny little sign that somebody tagged on the window, which said, "Don't Austin my Dallas." With that in mind, Greg Abbott came up with a very clever phrase when he ran for re-election, which was, "Don't California my Texas." I was doing a radio show earlier today out of Nevada, and the host said, "Don't California my Nevada." What was Greg Abbott getting at, though, when he said, "Don't California my Texas"?
Well, I think there's been a lot of talk in Texas about Texas being an alternative model for national politics versus California. Mm-hmm. California maybe is stereotyped as the kind of tax and spend, big government kind of place, whereas Texas is more individual freedom and liberty, less taxes, less services, more about entrepreneurship. So I think that to the degree that there are many Californians moving in, not just to Austin, but to the rest of Texas, I think there are some people who worry that maybe they might be interested in some aspects of California politics and governance, like maybe a state income tax. But I don't think that Texas really has to worry about that. I don't know if there's been a lot of stories, of course, and I don't know really if there's good data on this, that people who move out of California to go to Texas are just sort of sick and tired of all the California liberalism, and they just can't wait to get to the free open spaces of Texas. But I think a lot of those stories also end up having a kind of economic basis, like I retired and I wanted to go somewhere cheaper in my retirement, and you know, Texas property values are just a lot less than in California.
Right.
So I don't know to what degree there really is that kind of, you know, either way, ideological movement that people are coming either with, you know, liberal or conservative values to Texas.
When you look at California, David, East Coasters, New Yorkers, New Jerseyites who come to California, they tend to bring California sensibilities with them. They're left of center when they get to California. So I'd be very curious as to the Texas migration, if they're left of center, right of center. Anecdotally, people I know who've moved to mainly suburban Dallas, they're doing it for two reasons. One, there's a business opportunity that is much more lucrative, far easier than Texas, than in California. California, rated less than nation in business climate. Texas, obviously, far more friendly. And then also real estate. Just whatever they have for a home here in California, they can get a multiple of that in Texas, as it could in other states. So that seems to be driving them more than ideology or frustration with the big blue government in Sacramento. They see a better quality of life.
Well, I think there's a debate in political science about sorting. So are Americans sorting themselves? And you've heard a lot of this kind of thing that people want to live with like-minded people. Liberals want to live with liberals. Conservatives want to live with conservatives. And people are moving across the country in a way that is sort of sorting us and maybe tribalizing us and maybe making government gridlock even worse. But then there's also a lot of evidence, and I think it's much more convincing, which is that most people don't like politics, don't care about politics, are not reorganizing their lives in order to live with fellow partisans. People are living their lives for basic kind of economic, family kind of reasons. They're not trying to move to Texas or California or anywhere because they want to turn that state red or blue. Right. They just want to be able to live in a bigger house. They maybe want to start a business, or they see better job opportunities. So I think that there's been a lot of work here done at Hoover, in fact, by Mo Fiorina and others about, you know, sort of critiquing this sorting argument. But the vast majority of Americans are not watching cable news. They're not, you know, checking their Twitter account every single day. They care about the things that they care about. There's been some survey research that shows that there are lots of Democrats who would say they don't want their children marrying a Republican. And similarly, Republicans saying they don't want their children marrying a Democrat. But there's also survey evidence to show that lots of Red Sox fans don't want their children marrying Yankee fans. It's even larger than the partisan effect I've seen in some sort of experimental survey questions that have been put on. So I think we can sort of pick and choose these little kinds of data points here to think that we're in this polarized, tribalized America. But in point of fact, you know, probably not.
Right. So somebody very smart here in the Bay Area a few years ago came up with the idea of a house divided flag. And you see this around the annual big game between Cal and Stanford.
Yes.
And the flag is half Stanford and half Cal.
We have that in Texas. It's the UT A&M.
A&M.
But we don't play football anymore, which is a big shame. Hopefully we will.
Something the governor should mandate. So there is a George Bush who holds office in Texas. It is George P. Bush. He is the son of Jeb Bush, the nephew of George W. Bush, the grandfather of the late George H.W. Bush. He is a Texas land commissioner. Did a little digging on George P. Bush. He turned 43 in April, so he is a very young man politically. If he had to wait until 2026, this is assuming, we don't know, but assuming that Governor Abbott runs for a third term in 2022 and gets it, then let's assume it's open in 2026. George P. Bush would be 50 years old in 2026. George W. Bush, the uncle, was 49 in his first year as governor in 1995. Let's talk a bit about the Bush presence in Texas. I'm interested in two ways, David. First of all, this is a third-generation Bush now in Texas politics. The grandfather ran for office. Let's see, he first ran, what, for the Senate in 1964, I think? Then Congress in 66, so he goes back over half a century. The son comes along, he runs in the 1990s, and if you want to project this forward, here's a third Bush running statewide 30 years after that, so it's kind of a neat little transgression here, but let's talk about what George P. Bush faces that George W. Bush did not and George H.W. Bush did not.
Well, I think that he's certainly somebody to keep your eye on for the future. Mm-hmm. I kind of feel like he's laying low a little bit.
Yeah.
You hear about him sometimes in politics. He had a challenge. He had a primary challenge from the right. Right. Which he won by about 2-1. And he actually did fairly well statewide. I think he won by about 10 percentage points, if I remember correctly. And that's better than some of the other Republican statewide candidates did.
And was the challenge, David, was it a challenge on anything George P. had done? Or was it just the challenge based was a referendum on the last name?
I think it was just sort of a general kind of, you know, more Tea Party kind of, you know, let's see if there's an opportunity here to win a race.
Now, is he laying low because it's just not his moment to go statewide, waiting out Abbott or maybe a Senate opening? Or is he laying low because of the very complicated politics that Donald Trump presents?
Well, I think there's a lot of complications. There's the complication about being a Bush in mm-hmm. Republican politics right now.
Right.
I think that there's no reason for him not to wait. There are a variety of people who are already in office right now. I don't think there's any real political positive for him to start challenging in a primary. I think he would rather kind of wait for his opportunity. And this is generally true about political office holders. They're very careful about running for the next office. They don't want to give up the one they have unless they think they have a pretty good shot. And so it's not just him. It's lots of politicians who I think have that initial position. And then they sit around and then they look for their opportunity. And I think this is actually one of the challenges that Republicans are going to be facing in the future, which is that the Republicans haven't really been, to make a football metaphor again, haven't really been sort of playing against the varsity for a long time. Mm-hmm. So, and this is no disrespect for the Texas Democrats who have stepped up over the last couple decades to run for statewide office, because it's hard to run for statewide office if you're a Democrat in a red state or a Republican in a blue state. So they deserve a lot of credit, and you know the voters need to have politicians running for those positions. But at the same time, many of them have gotten blown out in these races, in part because they haven't been what political science calls a quality challenger. And that's not a moral judgment on them. It just means that they don't raise money. They don't have a lot of experience. They don't have a lot of name recognition. They find it difficult to win.
Right.
And so Texas Republicans have been winning some big margins, as you were talking about earlier. But on the other hand, it's not as if they've been running against sort of fully funded, really good candidates. So Beto raises $80 million. The governor candidate, Lupe Valdez, doesn't even raise $1 million.
Right, but a lot of Beto's money is from out of state.
Sure, and that's true about all candidates.
Right.
What's also going to happen, too, I think, is that you're going to see more and more Texas money staying in Texas. I think that's kind of a natural next step, because the national political parties essentially use Texas as a kind of giant ATM machine. They come in, they do a fundraiser in Austin or Houston or Dallas, and then they leave the same day. If you're a wealthy Democrat, why should you spend money in Texas politics? It's a waste of money. Why would you do that? So you give it to national candidates.
Right.
In the future, I think you're going to see more and more of that Texas Democratic money staying in state, and that's going to make it a more challenging political environment for Republicans when they start running against well-funded people. And they're also Democrats are going to start taking a risk, because right now, if you're a really talented Democratic state legislator or mayor, why would you run for statewide office? Like, there's no reason for that. But now with Beto, maybe people are thinking that, well, you know, if I catch a little lightning in a bottle and I can raise some money in state or out of state, yeah. And if the Republicans make any slips, then maybe I'm going to have a chance to get in there. And so I think that all these dynamics are going to make it a little more challenging. And that's just a sort of a side note to the George P. Bush kind of story, which is, you know, his waiting for his opportunity, I suspect.
So George P. has the luxury of both a famous last name, and he also has race to play as well. He is half Latino,
mm-hmm.
on his mother's side. Let's talk now about the Latino situation. To the old pollster's joke, David, that the Latino vote is a sleeping giant and always will be. Why is this the case? Why? It seems, getting back to the Charlie Brown metaphor, if you will, about the football, every 4 years we talk about, boy, this is the year that the Latino vote sends a solid message and shakes things up. And then this is especially true in 2016. We shake our heads and ask, what happened?
Well, it's one of the most ridiculous metaphors out there. The Latino as the sleeping giant. You know, it sort of calls to mind all these kind of stereotypical images of the sleepy Mexican that you sometimes see. And
yes.
But this metaphor gets used a lot, but it's really unfair. It's unfair to Latinos because if you look at who votes and who doesn't vote among the Latino population, you discover that it's pretty much the same as who votes in general. Mm-hmm. So in the American population on the whole, the older you get, the more likely you are to vote. The more education you have, the more likely you are to vote. Those are the two strongest determinants of whether or not you turn out on election day. Latinos are a young population, and they're a population that doesn't have a lot of education. That's changing. They're starting to move more up into the socioeconomic kind of profile, higher profile. Mm-hmm. of education, opportunity, occupation. But for the moment, you're still talking about, relatively speaking, a younger, less educated population. And that's just the profile of an individual who votes at a much lower rate. So when you take that into account, you don't really see a lot of differences between white and Latino voter turnout. There's a little bit of a drop-off for Latinos, even when you statistically control for them, for those factors like I've done in my own research. But it's really, it's like a single-digit kind of difference. So I wish that journalists and pundits out there would sort of realize that there's actually a lot of similarities between Latinos and whites when it comes to voter participation. They're responding to the same kind of factors. But there are all these pundits out there who think that, well, if only you just appeal to Latinos on some particular issue, you'll just get them to suddenly turn out. Well, that's not true either, because if you ask Latinos, what do you prioritize? The issues that they prioritize are pretty much the same issue agenda that everybody else does: jobs, economy, education. You know, in the 2000s, it was, you know, war in Iraq, Afghanistan, war on terror. There are very similar issue agendas. Now, Latinos may have, on the whole, a more liberal approach to some of those policy issues, but they sort of see the policy universe in a very similar way than whites do. So I think we need to look at some of the politics of similarity rather than the politics of difference. But there is this kind of self-perpetuating kind of, well, you know, Latinos don't turn out, so I guess we better not bother to spend money trying to turn them out, because, you know, we know that they'll just disappoint us and not turn out. In the meantime, if Latinos could speak with one voice, they'd be saying, what the heck?
Right.
You know, we turn out like anyone else does. It's also true, though, that lots of them live in states where their votes matter less, because they live in California, New York, Illinois, Texas. You know, Latinos have been most successful in Florida, because that's right. where it's been a much more non-Latino split vote.
Right. If you look at the exit polls, David, from 2016, Trump got about 28% of the Latino vote. Romney got about 27%. John McCain got about 31%. That's a rather static number in terms of not much variation there. Were you surprised that Trump got 28%?
I wasn't surprised. A lot of people in the punditry activist community were very surprised. And mm-hmm. there are some people who say that, no, he actually got more like 18% of the Latino vote. But I'm skeptical of those numbers, because they don't correspond to any of the other numbers that we have in political right. science polling.
Right.
I think there are good reasons to think that Latinos are probably in the mid to high 20% range for pretty much any Republican presidential candidate, mm-hmm. because the voting population mirrors a lot of the similar dynamics we see in the American population generally. So, for example, the strength of partisanship is one of the big findings in political science research over the last 70 years, ever since we really got going with the American National Election Study surveys in the 1950s. It's that partisanship is kind of a social identity. It's in our heads. It's like being a Yankees fan or a Red Sox fan. It doesn't change very easily, and we have seen some changes in the population, of course, over time, but it takes a lot to shake people from that predisposition. So to the degree that there are Latino Republicans, and I think it's about a third-ish of the Latino population that is probably either actively affiliating with the GOP or in some way sympathetic to it, it would take a lot to really sort of shake them substantially off that number, just like it would take a lot to shake most, you know, white Democrats off, you know, that number. It would take something unusual. So partisanship is in our head. So I'm not surprised. If you look at the data, one of the big things that has jumped out at us, or at least to me, who's interested in this subject, is religion. So it's not just that partisanship is anchoring Latinos or some Latinos to the GOP, it's also the religious differences. And you can see that with Bush's election in 2004, which was the first election that I really studied trying to figure out what was the Latino vote in that campaign. Bush got about 40% of the Latino vote. The Latinos who were the most supportive of him were Latino evangelicals and Pentecostals. So there's a big difference between Catholics and Protestants, although we're not talking about Protestants in the typical East Coast Episcopalian Presbyterian way. We're really talking more about, you know, evangelical kind of storefront sort of Protestants, as scholars might categorize them, but they might not see themselves as that. Lots of people in this category would say we're just Christian. But these Latinos are much more Republican than Catholics. Mm-hmm. And they're also and also much more than the so-called nuns, not the N-U-N-S, but the N-O-N-E-S, the growing number of Americans, especially young people who don't identify with any religious tradition. There's more of them among Latinos. They're also a more liberal group. So and this is how the Latino population changes over the generations. It becomes more Protestant. It becomes more evangelical. It becomes more Pentecostal. It becomes less Catholic and more nun. But this dynamic is essentially working well for the GOP, because the Latinos who are voting, and let's not confuse the Latino population with the Latino electorate, the Latino electorate are all citizens and they tend to be multi-generational, second, third, etc. And a lot of them are Protestant. And so they become more Protestant over time because they become more American, because Latinos do acculturate, contrary to some rumors out there. They really do in all sorts of ways. So as time goes on and this population acculturates, they become more Republican and they become more connected to Republican-oriented institutions. And these churches are also very good at turning people out, we think. Oh. I don't think we have a lot of great data on this, but because these tend to be smaller churches, more tight-knit, a little more cohesive than—
So these are not mega churches, these are small churches.
Yeah, these are predominantly smaller churches, although there are Latinos in every, you know, Protestant tradition, but you have a lot of Latinos who are very well networked into these smaller institutions, and I think that this explains some of the unexpected outcomes on election day, that they turn out at higher rates, I believe, because they are better networked in these religious institutions.
So the faith-based Latino, let's call it a faith-based Latino, what is he or she looking for in terms of issues? Because you talked earlier about jobs, you talked about immigration, you talked about the economy. Do values supplant those if you're faith-based?
Well, I think that faith-based as a general category can lead you into a whole variety of dimensions, directions politically.
Because but do cultural issues rise with them?
I think a little bit more so. I think that you probably have more. I mean, you know, abortion is the issue that Republicans have hoped for a very long time would sort of be a campaign issue that they could use to get Latino Democrats, and it hasn't really worked out that way. But to the degree that there are a big chunk of the Latino population that's Republican or open to Republicans, I think abortion does play some role there. Also, I think more generally, so arguments about Supreme Court nominees probably resonate a little bit in that community too. And I think they're also just a little more interested in kind of, you know, the GOP's opportunity, smaller government, religious liberty. I think there are a variety of issues that play well with that community.
What about the culture warrior issues you hear every night on Fox News, things like, you know, transgender bathrooms?
Well, I tend to think that those have not become major political issues.
No.
Now, I don't think that that's really what the average American is sort of, you know, thinking about when they go into the polls. And I think there's probably going to have – I haven't seen a lot of research on that. I think there's going to be more of that. There's been, of course, sort of culture war claims for a very long time. I think politicians and journalists and DC types believe in culture war arguments. I think your average American is not interested in fighting any kind of culture war. I don't think they see it in those terms. If you were to pay attention to pundits and beltway types, you would certainly believe that America had divided into these two angry opposing camps. But when you look at all the public opinion data, Americans are all bunched up into a kind of mushy middle on issue after issue after issue. Even politics, even issues we think are very divisive, like abortion, there are still lots of Americans bunched up into a, you know, well, kind of this, but kind of that at the same time. So I think that these culture war issues are great journalism and they're great punditry, but I don't think that a lot of them have necessarily resonated among Americans who really prefer moderate approaches on lots of things. They just don't get the politicians sometimes that give them those options. So they're stuck between these two parties that are
right.
increasingly more on the right and more on the left.
David, in August, national Latino advocacy group, Unidos U.S. is the name, Unidos U.S., they did a poll. Mm-hmm. Poll found that only 21% of Latinos whom they surveyed said they could vote for Trump. So there's a low number, 21%. 80% said they're frustrated by how the president and his allies treat immigrants. But they then asked them about the Democrats, and 60% said they're not going to take part in primaries. So there's nothing over on the Democratic side right now that floats their boat.
Right. Unidos, the former National Council of La Raza.
Okay.
I think that's kind of a low number. I think
Of a grain of salt poll is what you're saying.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. I wouldn't sort of take that and necessarily say, okay, fine, Trump's going to get 20%. I don't see why he would necessarily do any worse than he had done among Latinos, because he had been – maybe there's a difference between making a promise and carrying out on that,
right.
that promise, some people might claim. But on the other hand, he was pretty clear during the campaign that he wanted to do certain things, but it, like the border wall, for example. But as I said, the Latino population has all kinds of views, and
right.
and especially when you're talking about the Latino citizen voting group, the idea that they want that sort of an open borders policy just isn't borne out by the polling data.
Right. I was actually more curious about the Democratic number, the 60% saying that they are not going to vote in the primaries, which either shows a lack of enthusiasm or there's just not a candidate over there who is appealing.
Well, primaries have had this kind of low turnout problem for a long time,
right.
ever since, the 1970s came about, the McGovern-Fraser Reform Commission, and we were going to sort of bring more power to the people and we were going to create these primaries.
Right.
It was sort of like a party that people stopped showing up for.
Exactly.
And so, lots of people don't turn out in primaries. Primaries then can, in theory, create a problem because you can have more left people turn out in Democratic primaries, more right people turn out in Republican primaries, and then you get a left and a right candidate, and the American people, Latinos included, find
right.
themselves sort of in the middle choosing between these
right.
these candidates who don't necessarily represent them. That's a theory, at least. But about the Democratic primary, we'll actually have to see what happens. People are not very good predictors of their own political behavior sometimes, and so people may say they're not going to vote, but wait till the camp. There's so many candidates.
Right.
Let the Democrats sort of winnow it down a little bit, and then we'll see if it's between if it just turns out to be maybe Biden, Warren, Beto, maybe one or two other people. If you can get this large number of people with these multiple debates all down to like a group
right.
of people who can fit on one stage, the issues might be a little clarified, not just for Latinos, but for others too. I think it's going to be a high turnout election in general, though, just because 2018 was such a high turnout election.
But there is a Democrat running for president, David, who in theory should be appealing to Latino voters. And this gets us back to the sleeping giant metaphor that you clearly do not like. That is Julian Castro.
Yes, that's right. So I think that it points out that the Latino electorate is a diverse electorate and that Latinos are not just sort of simply voting for somebody because they're Latino. I think Latinos prioritize lots of things in the political world, and having a Castro has not necessarily sort of, in any way kind of electrified the Latino population of the United States or Texas in particular. I think Latinos are it's a complicated electorate, and I think that this sort of idea that I think had a little bit of resonance maybe about a decade or more ago that, if Democrats nominate a Latino for some office, they'll automatically get this enormous turnout of Latinos and they'll also get a more Democratic vote for those candidates. Well, I think that that's a bit of an oversimplification of the Latino electorate. So I don't think that if Democrats are counting on that or thinking about, Castro as a vice presidential candidate, that will make a difference. I mean, that's
right.
a little reminiscent of the Hillary Clinton campaign's idea that, Tim Kaine speaks fluent Spanish, and so maybe he'll appeal to Latinos. That didn't really seem to go anywhere. So, no disrespect to him for speaking Spanish. But
that's sort of a condescending attitude that if a white man can speak Spanish, then he'll connect to people who speak Spanish, whereas Mr. Castro is obviously from the Latino community. Did he grow up in El Paso as well?
Oh, I think San Antonio.
San Antonio, that's right, and he's of Stanford as well.
Yes, undergraduate.
But this may be worth revisiting next summer, not to get too far over our skis, but in a world where Elizabeth Warren is the Democratic nominee, she's going to go shopping for a running mate. And Democrats have long had this fascination with Texas in this regard. I remember all the way back in 1988 and going to the Democratic National Convention in Atlanta, where Democrats chanted Boston, Austin. Why? Because they had a presidential nominee from Massachusetts and Michael Dukakis, and they had a vice presidential nominee, Lloyd Benson, senator from Texas, mm-hmm. just like John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. So there might be, given both this fascination with winning Texas, David, but also bumping the Latino vote, Mr. Castro could be a running mate for her.
I think Benson Dukakis might have won. Democrats had it maybe backwards there, but in any case. Exactly.
But this gets us back to the idea, though, David, that, okay, we put a Latino man on the ticket. He's going to drive the Latino vote.
Yeah, I don't think that there is really much evidence that a dynamic like that exists. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's much evidence in general that the vice presidential nominee matters at all.
Yeah.
It might matter from the statistical evidence I've seen. It might gain the nominee maybe a couple percentage points in the home state of the vice presidential candidate.
Right.
So maybe if you believe that, you might think that, well, that might be just enough effect to put somebody over the top, a Democrat over the top in Texas. But I mean, which Democrat would you choose? Would you choose Castro or Beto?
Exactly.
And Beto's doing much better in the polls than Castro. So you might very well say, well, Beto, he may not be Latino, but he has a Latino nickname. And he's done really well. And there's something about him that caught on with the Texas electorate. If we look at the last election cycle, we see that Lupe Valdez, who was the sheriff of Dallas, lost by 13 points and didn't raise, politically speaking, hardly any money at all. She didn't really sort of seem to motivate a big kind of grassroots groundswell of Latino voters turning out, just like the Latino gubernatorial candidate in Arizona in 2018 went down to defeat also by a much larger number than the Democratic Senate candidate did, who won. So I think that voters, or Latino voters even, are differentiating. The exit polls show that Latino voters in 2018 in Texas were more likely to support Beto than they were to support Lupe Valdez. So right. I'm very skeptical of these ideas that, oh, well, we'll just put Castro on the ticket and it'll all be great in Texas. I just think the evidence for that is not strong.
Yeah. Well, you'd put him in Texas, but then maybe what you'd do, and not to be too crass about this, but you would target him to specific states where he could maybe juice the Latino vote a couple of points. Eastern Pennsylvania is a good example of this.
Yeah, I feel like all the attention in a presidential campaign goes to the presidential candidate.
Right.
I just don't think that with all of that, especially, you know, Trump, who's going to be really the centerpiece of the campaign, I think it may almost matter less who the Democrats nominate this year than in previous years, because Trump is such an overwhelming focus of all the media attention. I was just watching some cable news show at lunch in the background, and it was just all Trump. It was just every single second of that.
It's such an important point that people have to understand, that traditionally in a presidential election, you know, two parties get covered and almost equally. But Donald Trump so sucks the oxygen out of the room in terms of media. Good luck for the Democratic candidate to get as much time, and really good luck for the vice presidential candidate.
Especially,
time,
yeah.
Right? This is your time in the podcast now, David, to offer some free advice. So if the President of the United States wants to increase his numbers with Latinos, if the Republican Party wants to increase his numbers with Latinos, what are the first steps?
Well, I think that he probably has to see that he's going to get a chunk of the Latino vote no matter what. So even if Trump were to do no outreach, let's say, to Latinos, I still think he would probably do about as well as he did last time. So, you know, he's not going to go down into the 10-15% kind of range. And Republicans don't really need to win the Latino vote. They just probably want to keep it as high as it can so that it could make a difference in some states that have very razor-sharp kind of non-Latino vote margins.
But for the National Party, it's a concern, because the National Party is now looking at congressional races around the country. So now we can start targeting specific districts, especially here in California, where the disconnect is a problem.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I really want to sort of, you know, give national-level political advice to any candidates right now. I think that looking at a lot of this data on Trump's public opinion, that I just don't know, like, what's going to really move a lot of that.
Right.
I mean, he still won last time, so he could still win again with the same kind of strategy. I just don't know, like, if I can really give him some advice that's going to take his public opinion ratings and move them from the low 40s into the high 40s. And
I think you're saying he's kind of locked into where he is. So now maybe the question, David, is come 2021, where either Trump is serving another four terms, but he's a lame duck, or he's
four terms?
No, 4 years. Sorry, excuse me. Or he's out of office altogether. We are already moving on to 2024. It's a wonderful nature of politics. We're always talking about the next friggin' election.
Yeah.
At which point, Republicans have to talk about what the Republican Party is. 2016 fascinates me in this regard, David. It's one of those elections where I think both parties walked away in some regards the worse for the wear. In that Democrats are going through a very public identity crisis right now. And if you put 15 Republicans on the stage, they'd have the same identity crisis as to who we are, what we believe in. Mm-hmm. But part of that conversation come 2021, 22, 23, 24 is going to have to do with the Republican Party's relationship with Latino voters.
Sure. And I think first of all, going back to 2016, we have to remember what an unusual election that really was.
Yes.
I mean, we had two candidates who were sort of, world record holder unpopular. I mean, Trump versus Clinton was, by all standards of public opinion polling, two candidates who were the most disliked of any presidential major party candidates in recent years.
It's interesting, as I was looking up some numbers on Trump the other day, right track, wrong track. So I went to Real Clear Politics and saw their average on it. And the right track, wrong track right now is incredibly ugly. It's about 35 right and about 59% wrong. And I thought, well, the public must have been in a much better mood in 2016. Almost the same exact numbers in January 2017, November 2016.
That's right.
Maybe it's just voters locked into a sour mood because they don't like the choices facing them.
Yeah, and I think that helps the candidate who's not the incumbent. So I think that the evidence I've seen is that Hillary lost the vote of people who wanted change and they thought things were going in the wrong direction. Well, that may very well turn against Trump going into the next election. I've seen some related data like that in Texas about, is the nation going in the right direction with the no's outnumbering the yeses in Texas.
Right. But to the concept, David, that the Republican Party will, regardless of the outcome of the next election, start pivoting away from Trump and figure out what it is post-Trump.
Well, sure. Yeah, they always have to pivot away no matter what.
Right.
Because they've really got to sort of build up the next candidate for the next election. And they can't just be living in the past too much because that's not really helpful. On the other hand, I think that who wins in the next election will make a huge difference because the spin of an election is huge. So if you remember back when Barack Obama won his second term and the Republicans had that the autopsy where they were going to analyze why they lost and they were going to do a lot of more sort of minority outreach and they were going to sort of, go back to the George W. Bush Big Ten kind of tradition. But of course, those kinds of plans have a way of getting upended by reality. And so
along comes a guy who runs completely countercurrent to all of that. And lo and behold, he gets elected.
Mm-hmm, that's right. So, but if maybe 80,000 people had changed their votes in four states, we would be having a completely different conversation. It would be about how, the U.S. is different than maybe Britain and Brexit. The U.S. is sort of, turned to another path, and it's now going to be a Democratic majority fueled by, liberal whites and, minority Democrats and immigrants. And instead, the conversation turns around. And I think that in 2020, depending on who wins, we're going to get one of two completely different conversations, which in a sense doesn't, again, do justice to the American who's in the middle here, who doesn't really want to see America go in any one kind of, wingnut direction. They really want a kind of, moderate middle ground kind of politics, but maybe that's not what the parties are giving them. But the outcome of this election is, I think, going to be the spin that's going to determine how both parties see what their tactics should be going forward. A Republican victory will be a very different thing than an Elizabeth Warren victory in presidency, let's say.
Mm-hmm. And the Latino vote, David, goes in that same concern, as you said, about voters in general, about just wanting this middle ground.
I think so. I think that Latinos are sort of a natural 2-to-1 Democratic constituency. So to a certain degree, the current politics are leaving some Latino voters on the table for the mm-hmm. GOP. But they are getting a pretty big chunk, I think, 25, 26, 27, 28. I mean, that's not really bad for a Republican candidate, especially if you compare it with, let's say, the African-American vote, which is much more Democratic in the 90-some percent range.
Right.
I also want to say just one thing, too, about the Asian American vote, because we don't often talk about this in politics. But this is a group that's growing, and it's also growing in some states like Texas, and so they could make a difference. In 1984, Reagan won 3/4 of the Asian American vote, and in 2016, Hillary won over 3/4 of the Asian American vote. So it's not the exact same people, because there's been lots of migration and naturalization. But at the same time, this is sort of an unintended consequence in some ways of national politics, that the Asian American community is, I think, sort of looking more toward the Democratic Party as its home in a way that they may have been less likely to do so 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And the Latino population, has it always drifted Democratic? Or you mentioned Reagan's numbers, for example.
Yeah, if you look over time, you see that it really goes back and forth. When I say 2-to-1 as an average, that's just an average that obscures a lot of variation. Right. It can go low in an unusual year like 1996 or when you had Ross Perot or one of those kinds of – or 92
right.
also. When you have those kinds of elections, it can mess up the numbers and it can make someone like Dole look like he actually did worse than he probably really did in a sense. But over time, the further back you go in time, the worse the data are and the less sure you are. Like, what did Eisenhower do among Latinos? We don't know, but there's an estimate out there. I don't believe it because we weren't really surveying Latinos in any kind of scientific, systematic way. So who knows how Eisenhower did, but it varies back and forth with national trends. So candidates that are generally popular, like Reagan or Bush, do well among all groups. And candidates that are generally not very popular do less well among all groups. And so it's hard to look at a Latino vote in isolation from where the national politics are.
Mm-hmm. Final question, David. You look at the Latino vote, you look at Latino voters, and you look at politicians. Is there a politician in America right now who kind of understands how to talk, how to communicate? And what I guess I'm getting at is somebody who does not speak directly to Latino voters, does not try to pander, try to do the obvious things like speaking in Spanish or doing certain hot-button issues, but someone who just communicates and appeals to the Latino community.
Yeah, I don't think, as you said, I don't think it's a matter of pandering. I don't think that's really very effective as a strategy, trying to sort of see Latinos as being something, a different group that we have to differentially appeal to.
It just seems to me there's a temptation among especially national politics to try too hard, like somebody on their first date who's just trying too hard. So they come into a community and they try to speak Spanish and they try to make a connection in some way and they eat ethnic food and so forth. It's trying too hard.
It's trying too hard. It was sort of like, if you remember, Hillary Clinton was like your Latina grandmother kind of thing. If you remember that.
Yes.
I mean, there are things that people do that I think they're trying to appeal to Latinos, but maybe they don't quite understand what's really driving the Latino vote. I think Latinos are interested in a lot of the issues that Americans are interested in. And as I said, they're probably a little bit more liberal on many of them. They seem to be a little bit more of a tax and spend population than the average white voter, but at the same time, I think that we do better when we see Latinos as being American voters and we see them as being motivated by many of the very same factors. Because if you look over time, you'll see the white vote and the Latino vote, there's a partisan gap, but it goes in the same direction. So these are kind of like parallel roller coasters with a kind of gap between them. So if politicians are looking for, you know, the right food to eat or the right Spanish words to say, I've got no advice for them because I just don't think that's going to really be very effective. But if you want to get to 40%, like Bush did, you know, can you just simply recreate it by adopting a few policies? Well, probably not, because that was a unique time, 2004, and Bush was a, you know, unique individual. And so we're not talking about someone who can just sort of in some formulaic way recreate that. But I do think that Latinos respond best to the opportunity society approach of the GOP. So when the GOP is talking about, you know, getting into the middle class, getting your share of the American dream, being sort of, you know, freed up to live your dreams, I think that kind of talk resonates a lot better with Latinos.
So I think what you're saying is that the George P. Bush presidential campaign in 2032 will get this just right.
It could very well. Yes. Yes, there could be. I think for the first time in American history, three generations of presidents.
Special
the same
times.
Family.
Okay, so let it be known, David Leal, that on October the 8th of 2019, you have put to rest the sleeping giant metaphor.
I hope I have. Thank you.
Well, David, I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to America's 45th president. In this podcast, the changing face of the great state of Texas. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us. And tell your friends about us. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows, that certainly includes David Leal, straight to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is at Hoover Inst. That's at Hoover INST. David Leal is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at Leal David L. Let me spell it out for you. LEALDAVIDL. At Leal David L. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.